Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, welcome back. This is the Emergent on Golf podcast. We hope everyone is doing well out there. Back to a three-man show. McLean is back alongside Jay and I. And we got more adventures in the Boyd household tonight. So again, all kinds of sounds going behind. Household guests, other kids, could be some yelling. You never know. But McLean, how are you? Welcome back.
Man, it's just good to be here with you three. I mean, you two, us three. Whatever, you know, it's just good to be back.
Us three. There you go. Jay Byrne, how are you? What's going on?
I'm great. Go. Ready to get after it. Talk a little G.
Little G.
I love it.
We got plenty to talk about.
Plenty to talk about. What are you guys drinking before we talk about G?
I've got some Michter's American whiskey, US 1.
That sounds so good.
Can't really get a bottle of that. Can't really get in Virginia. But anytime we went up to Baltimore last weekend for Trey's lacrosse tournament, and my wife was going to get some wine. You can't buy wine at like a grocery store, so you have to go to a liquor store. She was getting wine. I was like, can you give me some bourbon while you're up there? Just see what they have, you know? Just because, you know, it's different. They got different stuff. See what they have. So she's telling me the normal stuff, and I'm like, can you FaceTime? So I got her to FaceTime, and then as soon as she was scanning, she's like, I got this Michter. And I'm like, yep, stop. How much is that? She told me the price. I said, yep, grab that one. Yep. And then she kept scrolling. She was like, okay, Knob Creek 9, Knob Creek 12. I was like, stop, get that. And then she scrolled a little further, and she found another couple other stuff. I'm like, all right, I'm going to stop with these two bottles. Can you just get these two? She's like, are you serious? You want me to get both of these? I'm like, these will last me like a month. Your bottle of wine will last you one night.
Yeah, exactly.
So I was like, don't say anything.
Yeah, there's just a reminder, in every bottle of bourbon, there's 17 pours. Exactly. In every bottle of wine, there's 4.
Exactly. So.
I feel like 17 is debatable.
Well, I'm not sure how heavy your hand is, McLean, but I think it's pretty heavy.
It's not light.
Maybe less for you. So, but in the true measurement, there's 17.
We got you. I'm drinking a little bit of Espolon and Sapa Chico.
Huh?
Hint of lime with a little lime, fresh lime on top.
I like it.
It's just a good drink. Doesn't hurt in the morning.
I just poured the last little bit of an Eagle Rare bottle.
Oh, every time.
So good.
Every time.
So good. It's hard to throw the bottle away, know that another one's down, but luckily I got two more backups here. So
you would.
Jesus. Again.
It's unreal.
Bourbon shaming is unbelievable on this podcast.
Yeah, without question.
Jeez. All right, let's get some golf. So past week we had two national opens. We'll start on the men's side of the RBC Canadian Open. Big shot Bob McIntyre gets his first PGA Tour win. Got his dad on the bag. Cool little scene there with Rory's girlfriend. I mean Amanda Baliones after the round. came to tears on the 18th green, and it was kind of a roller coaster final round for the guy. I was kind of in and out watching it. And like, I'd step in front of the TV and watch, and he'd flare one way off the planet. I'm like, oh, this guy's starting to lose it. Then all of a sudden he'd go like birdie. I'm like, oh, maybe not. And then he'd flare one off the planet again. He seems like one of those players that's greater than the sum of his parts. Am I off base there?
He's
an overachiever.
Overachiever.
He's scrappy. He is scrappy without question.
And again, we've talked about this before. Like, what's the determining factor here, given his skill set from a technical side and a physical side? Like, nothing that stands out, you know. Yeah. But he's a PGA Tour winner. You know, that it factor that we can't, the non-measurable, the intangible that we can't really, you know, quantify, which we've tried to, but like that clutchness, that it factor, Some people have it and they just can get it done. I mean, that is the beauty about this game. And I know we'll get into it. We'll talk about some other things. We're going to talk about, the longest day in golf, but some people that I play with, two different types of people, that got the job done in different ways. But that's, again, back to the main point. That's the beauty of this game. You can have a guy who's very calculated, very intricate with the process, and is very regimented and very consistent, and they can kill you with consistency. And you have the super duper athletic person that can wow you with certain skills. But when, and in the day, are you shooting the same score, or is one person better than the other? I don't know. It's kind of cool to watch. I mean, there's not a lot of sports like that. Yeah. No. Football, like, either you're big, you're fast, you're strong. Like, you got to have those things. Like,
yeah.
If you're not, not playing,
I totally
get run over.
Yeah. I totally agree. And Bob doesn't strike you. You watch him hit balls. You're like, all right, he's a good player. You can hear the way he hits it and you would know he's a good player, but you wouldn't watch it and think all of a sudden that this guy is an absolute stud. But he did go out, finish first in strokes gained putting this week, which happens often with guys that win PGA Tour events. He's been threatening for the last couple of years to do something cool. You know, he's played well in a lot of different events. He's become a little bit of a name that if you're really involved, you recognize it. But if you're not, if you're someone who's kind of a Sunday watcher, you probably don't know who the guy is. But on the backside of that, the stats are great from this past week. I mean, the highest ranking he had was 39th in approach to the green. Everything else is in the top 10 or just outside of that in the strokes for the strokes gained, or ultimately any stat that you look at for the tournament. So he played well. The coolest thing that I saw was him being able to share that moment with his dad on the 18th green. I think that's something that all of us have always wanted to do. It's certainly something I grew up wanting to do with my pops. Obviously, there's some things that get me out of that.
Yeah.
That circle. But on the backside of that, there was such a great moment, such a good story behind it. A guy who's been playing well for a long time, a guy who I think is ready to start to really kind of make a name for himself. I mean, if I'm not mistaken, he was a captain's pick last year's Ryder Cup. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. He was captain's pick. Yeah. So from the European side, he's been playing well for a long time. And now he's starting to do it. This is his first year on tour. He has spoken out and said that, he's felt a little lonely out there. He didn't really know a lot of the guys. But I think, and Jay, you can respond to this the way I would, is, once you win out there, all of a sudden you start getting a lot more head nods on the driving range.
Yeah, people know who you are.
People know who you are. Hey, Bob, how you doing? Hey, Bob. Hey, Bob, Bob, Bob. And all of a sudden you start to get more comfortable. It wouldn't surprise me if this wasn't his only win this year. The guy's been playing great for a long time. He's been kind of a sleeper pick for a lot of guys for a while. And I think ultimately this is an opportunity for him to, pick up that, proverbial, whatever you want to call it, pick that up and start to run with it a little bit. The guy's great. But ultimately, when I look back at it, the moment that he had with his dad, it's just one of the purest feelings in the world. And I'm so excited that he had that moment with him, for not just him, but for his father as well. And the fact that he had his father on the bag, it was just, man, that was cool.
Yeah. I take it back. He actually made the team on points.
Oh, he made it on points. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. He made it on points. But regardless, all I was saying is that he's been playing very well. He's
playing great.
He got himself there. He is a former Ryder Cupper, which, even as someone who's not a big follower of the game, to realize that this guy was a former Ryder Cup player. This is not a no-name. He may not be in your repertoire when it comes down to the first guys that you rattle off and talk about great golfers in the world, but this guy is a stud. He's an absolute stud. He's not a no-name.
And he did, he has talked about how he hasn't enjoyed it as much on the PGA Tour. It's a little lonely. He doesn't know as many of the guys. And I think he has just taken up residency or part-time residency in Orlando when he's over here. But apparently he's a pretty big homebody and still lives in his hometown. It's like Oban, Scotland. And it's a tiny little town. And he's just kind of really close with his family, close with his friends. And hell, he's WD'd from the Memorial this week. And he went back to Scotland
to a party with his friend. I respect
have a few pints. Few pints.
I bet he had more than a few. He had 11 teen a night, I guarantee.
Yeah, it was just, you know, and then I don't know if you guys caught it. He was, Jay, I know you were playing a practice round on Sunday, so you might not have caught a lot of this, but he was bitching and moaning about the CBS drones.
Oh, buzzing while he was hitting?
Buzzing while he was hitting. He complained a couple times, and one was a pretty good hot mic, and he like looked at the guy like from CBS. He's like, I've told you guys multiple times. I've talked to a rules official. Like, get that thing away. And I was kind of shocked at like what Nance and Dottie Pepper and Immelman were all mentioning, like, oh man, this guy has been like fidgety all day. He's got rabbit ears. He's hearing everything out there. He's hearing spectators. I guess he was moving spectators around all day and like, hey, shut your phone off. Shut up. Stop walking. Like, so the guy was definitely on edge the whole final round. Well, just kind of was interesting to the interplay of, hey, I'm trying to get my first real big win here. Yeah. And
can you guys just chill out for a little bit?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this may have, and I'm trying to look up stats right now on this, but like this may have been the first time that he was really in the hunt for a PGA Tour event. And I may be wrong. I'm trying to look it up as fast as I can, but it's a different league than what he grew up playing at over in Europe. Like it's just a different league. I've been over there and when you're in the hunt on Sunday, especially as the rest of the field is finishing, everyone gathers on those last few holes to watch the last group come in. And there's a lot of noise. There's without question, a ton of noise. Yeah. I mean, looking at it, he did finish eighth at the PGA. So you got to feel like he had some noise there. 13th Myrtle Beach. He missed a bunch of cuts early. But this may have been the first time where he was really around the noise that a tournament like a Memorial can bring to you.
Sure.
The RBC Canadian.
Yeah, and that's a big time tournament. There's a lot of fans there. The Canadians take that thing seriously. And so like he had a T6 at Mexico at Vedanta, which is a resort. You're never gonna get a ton of fans there or a lot going on, right? Everyone's on vacation. It's not so the last time we really saw him, I guess technically it was PGA Tour event, but it's a co-sanctioned event, was the Genesis Scottish Open, where he hit those incredible shots coming down the stretch, and then Rory kind of matched him and edged him out. But that was obviously his home soil.
Yeah, that crowd is totally different. I've been over there. They're incredibly respectful. They're not rowdy. They're a big crowd.
Well, and he had a lot of support because it was the Scottish Open. So,
without question. But having caddy for my dad in Scotland, it's a totally different type of venue. Like, we were over there one day. It kept raining, and the harder the rain came, the more people that came out. And it baffled me. I'm sitting there going, in the U.S., this isn't a thing. Guys don't do this. Like, they're very respectful of the game. It's a totally different vibe. They award good shots, but they're not rowdy in between shots. That's the best way I could try to put it. The Canadian Open, for those guys, this is their biggest event of the year. It's, if I'm not mistaken, is it the only event that we have up there?
It is.
They come out for this, and it's finally sunlight. They don't have to curl every night. Like, they're not playing hockey for the day. And they come out, and they just get absolutely belligerent. And
everyone is in a boot out there for this.
Yeah, exactly. So, regardless, I think that's something of – I don't think we'd have seen some American players necessarily respond that way because they're used to being, you know, around that atmosphere. But for him, look, let's look back on this real quickly. Let's not take nothing away from him. He took all of that in stride and still hoisted the trophy. I got mad respect for that. Signed his scorecard.
Well, and the other thing, too, that's kind of interesting is of the 10 DP World Tour graduates from last year, essentially, you could call them, or, you know, the guys that got their cards on the PGA Tour through the DP Tour. I mean, we now had two win. So you had Matthew Pavon earlier at Torrey, and now Bob McIntyre. Victor Perez has had a solid little year. Ryan Fox has had a solid year. A couple other guys that have played well. Rio Hishatun, however you said that name, so I apologize. So some of these Euros from the DP World Tour are coming over and showing like, hey, boys, you know, yeah, the bottom of our tour may not be as strong, but us guys at the top, we can still play and compete.
Yeah,
that's absolutely correct. I don't think anyone on this podcast ever questioned that.
Oh no, we haven't. But I think the general golfing public looks down a lot on the DP World Tour.
I'm on my couch. Are you winning?
That wasn't your kid that walked by. None of your kids have ponytails.
One of them was my kid. The other one was. Apparently, it's raining out there, and they've been raining. We are so wet, and it's like great timing. Awesome.
Oh shit. Yeah. Anyway, I thought that was interesting about the DP World Tour. So they're kind of showing up a little bit this year. So. Anything else from the Canadian Open?
No.
Rory plays well, not great, but well, finishes three back, T4. Couple Canadians up there. Tom Kim goes deep on the weekend, 65, 64. Yeah, that's about it, I guess, from the Canadian Open. Did you catch any of the anyone catch any of the women's open? U.S. women's open? Probably the biggest.
A couple of the highlights, yeah.
Biggest tournament on their schedule, biggest purse. Yuka Saso wins her second. She's like the Brooks Koepka now of the LPGA Tour. She has no regular events, but she's got two majors.
No big deal.
She's only 22 years old. She's got two.
Good for her.
U.S. women's opens. It's fun. I'll say it's fun watching her swing a golf club. It's she's kind of copied her swing off after Rory, the driver swing, and
God, is it
she hit some incredible shots coming down the stretch. She's like 4 under on the back nine. Everyone was kind of struggling, and even she turned and 2 over on the day, or 1 over on the day. And she shot 3 under on the back. I apologize, I forgot she bogeyed 17 late. But man, she hit an incredible shot. I think it was 15. It's like 190 yards uphill, like severely uphill, ball above her feet, had to hit a cut, like a 5 iron, hits it to like 4 or 5 feet. I was like, that's a shot not many players in general can hit, never mind women, right?
It was a woman, doesn't matter, like you're,
yeah,
most people can't hit that.
Yeah. I heard a quote, I think it was her caddy, it said like, yeah, there might be 10 women on this tour that can hit that shot, and that's about it. And luckily I'm carrying the bag for one of them. So
that's pretty cool.
Yeah. So I thought the golf course, I'm going to pronounce this wrong. Lancaster Country Club.
Lancaster.
Yeah, you know, Lancaster.
Okay. Got it. Sweet.
It looked mint.
Yeah. Obviously the big news, probably what most people took away from the tournament, was Nelly Korda, third hole of the tournament, makes a 10. The par 3 12th, which was just eating everyone alive. Big, huge false front, goes down to a creek, all these bunkers long. She makes a mess of the hole. But yeah, that golf course looked cool. I mean, it had some like severe elevation changes, like from like hitting up to these greens. You just don't, I guess we don't get that many golf tournaments in the Northeast. Well, you see that a lot in the Northeast, but
yeah. I love it. I think it's awesome.
It's cool. There's a lot of character to it.
I mean, granted, you know, from a, you know, golf enthusiast like you, like you like watching the first golf courses in the country, and they all tend to be more in the Northeast. Just,
sure,
that's just kind of where golf originated in the U.S. But you see some of these golf courses, and not to go down a rabbit hole like we normally do, but golf architecture and the architects trying to restore the golf course to what it was originally. And, you know, some people love it. Some people are like, hey, I like seeing this tree that's 100 years old. That, granted, it was only 10 years old when the golf course was designed and built, but now it's part of the golf course and everybody loves playing it because of the way that it looks. And, it, you know, different takes on it. But I would say for the most part, people, when they think of Northeastern golf, they think of big trees and, mm-hmm. you know, tree-lined fairways, and that's slowly changing. But this golf course had a little bit of that along with the terrain changes and so forth. So it was pretty neat. I mean, it's a neat track.
Yeah, sure. I was just thinking of something. This has nothing to do with golf. You said going down a rabbit hole.
Yeah.
Well, which we do that a lot. And you and I also enjoy the Rabbit Hole bourbon. I think we need to speak to them when we're in Louisville.
We need to get an E9 bottle like that. We need to get
I think they need to sponsor us.
Yeah.
You know,
well, just throwing that out there.
Just throwing it out there for anyone that worked at Rabbit Hole. I think we could work out a great partnership.
They're definitely listening.
Absolutely listening. We could have a segment, you know, the Rabbit Hole segment of the week.
Love to.
I like where we're at.
We'll pitch them that idea in September. So
I should
in Louisville, if you guys heard Scottie Scheffler's press conference, I think it was yesterday, he referred to the Louisville police twice.
He did say that. Oh no. Yeah. That's not helping your cause here, Scotty.
Hey, the guy's, no pun intended, he's scot-free.
we haven't talked about that. We assumed last week, Jay and I assumed when they were calling the press conference that they were going to drop the charges, which they ended up doing. And so it's kind of rightfully so. That's what should have happened.
Yeah. I mean, I think for all the naysayers out there, that's fine. I agree that you want to, when there's smoke, there's fire. So they say, and I agree with that for the most part. I think this was not a case of where there was smoke, there was fire. I think there was an angry cop who had a moment where he was trying to, you know, present his dominance over people in general. And he took it to the next level. And I think we've seen multiple videos, and then the rebuttal to all the videos that we've seen is like, oh, well, you missed the part. You missed this part where he dragged him. You missed this part where he dragged him. I'm like, I've seen 10 videos. Like, how could all 10 of these people miss this video? And like security cameras miss this video of Scottie Scheffler dragging this cop for 20 yards.
And then there was the audio that came out of him talking to the other cop. And he was like, over and over, he's like, I didn't know he was a cop. And then he says, like, the guy like reached in the window and like hit him with a flashlight. Yeah, I didn't know it was a cop. I just thought it was some random traffic guy. I would drive away from a guy who was hitting me with a flashlight. Like,
yeah, and they had like yellow, like traffic, you know, shirts or vests on. That doesn't mean you're a cop. Like, there's plenty of traffic people that don't know what the hell's going on.
Especially at an event like that.
At an event like that, like, everyone wears those. Like, and the cop, you're right, Mike, the cop that was interviewing, I thought it was an absolute joke. The guy was like, you know, well, there's your mistake, sir. When someone tells you to stop, you stop regardless. I'm like, what? No. If I'm driving a car and I get some idiot that's trying to stop my car, and I don't know who the hell he is, I'm not stopping for that maniac. Like, why would I stop and let this guy open my car door and hit me with a flashlight? Like, I'm not
He hit the window with a flashlight. So I saw the video. He hammered the window with a flashlight.
No, this was before.
There was no dragging.
Apparently that happened before we saw the video, like before you could see his car on the video.
Okay. Regardless of which, this was always going to be dropped. These charges were always going to be dropped.
Yeah.
They came out and said that there's no, randomly they came out and said, best way to say this, we don't have any body cam footage. And it's like, what? Wait a minute. What do you mean you don't have any body cam footage? And then all of a sudden all the videos come out and they're like, all right, we're going to drop the charges. Yeah. You don't think that this was a guy on a power trip? This was obviously a guy on a power trip.
And then did you see his statement, the cop's statement? He put out a press release or whatever, and like,
yeah,
you could tell like the main body of the thing was crafted by a lawyer, and then
without question.
PS about the whole pants, and I'm like, what is going on here? This is weird. The whole thing was odd.
It was terrible all the way around. The charges were always going to be dropped. It was like, you know, we all talked about it before. If this was any other guy, maybe. But there's not one person on tour. There's not one person in the media that was like, no, that sounds like Scotty. Everyone's like, nope, that makes no sense. Not a chance.
Yeah, there's never,
I think I've said this before, but there's never been anyone with like had like the most benefit of the doubt given to him by the masses than like Scottie Scheffler.
Yeah.
It made no sense from the get go. And ultimately it ended up being a joke, and like all respect to the guy that lost his life.
Sure.
And his family. Don't want to take anything away from that. But on the backside of that, this was a cop on a power trip. When they looked at it, he had a record of doing things like this. He's been suspended, I want to say 5 to 6 times for similar action. And I also want to look at the judicial services and say, wait a second. You got a guy that's been suspended 5 to 6 times for similar actions. Why does he still have a badge?
Yeah, I know. That's the part that's...
Like, how hard is it to get fired?
It's hard, apparently.
If I'd have done something like that with my job, I wouldn't have a job.
Yeah, like I said to Jay last week, it's like something out of Super Troopers.
Yeah.
It's crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Sorry, we skipped over Yuka Saso. Anything else from the Women's Open you guys want to take? Anything interesting there? Okay, looks like we're taking a quick bourbon break as Jay's shaking his empty glass at me furiously in the camera. All right, so U.S. Women's Open, we're going to get to the U.S. Open, and the longest day in golf.
Let's go.
Was 2 days ago. Sorry, I guess I should have let this off of the show. At the top of the show, we're doing this on a Wednesday night. Sorry, one because Jay was in the longest day in golf on Monday, and then his wife had a birthday yesterday. So
such a proud moment for us.
Yeah, absolutely. We had a host in the longest day in golf, U.S. Open. They've now changed it to the U.S. Open final qualifying from sectional qualifying.
Final
qualifying. We'll get to some of the other results, but Jay Bird, how was the experience?
It was awesome. I mean, I haven't played in the final qualifying since 2017, so that's 7 years. There's a lot of change has happened since 2017. That was the last year that I was playing full time, and I was kind of probably more physically fit to walk 36 holes and to swing a golf club 150 times, which is pretty close to what I swung it. It was awesome. That the golf course there at Woodmont and Rockville is just incredible. They literally set it up like a tour event or a mini U.S. Open. And granted, the rough was thick. It wasn't as thick as the U.S. Open, but the greens were very firm. The fairways were very firm, which also helped with the scoring. You know, if you were driving the ball well and keeping the ball in play, you could. Yeah, a lot of birdie opportunities, but it was set up perfectly. I mean, it was a great contest, and the whole the weather was like 75 to upper 70s, sunny, very low wind. The greens were receptive, but they weren't too fast. They were probably rolling like 10.5, 11 max, which is like super makeable speed for. Especially for guys who are playing tour golf, you know, I think there's probably some amateurs that played that thought maybe they were a little fast but for the guys on tour, I mean, they typically play around 10, 10 and a half, 11. I'd say 11 would be 10 and a half, 11 would be comfortable for them. When it gets to 12, 12 and a half, things get a little dicey and you have to think a little bit more. And if they get to 10 to 9.5, that's too slow. Guys get irritated. So they kind of hover around that 10.5, 11, 11.5 is kind of the max. And that's right where the greens sat. And they were set up perfectly. The greens were great. Mike, I think it's Cumberpatch, is the director of the Washington Metropolitan Golf Association. He did a great job. He does it every year. And he sets the course up great. And they don't change the pins. They keep the same pins for 36 holes. Yeah, we talked for a little bit about that, and he just basically, his response was very simple. He said, there's too many things that can go wrong when we change the pins. We can not do it fast enough. We can mess up, not get the pins in the right location. And two, if they do, by us changing the pins, that's more, you know, from a, you know, operational standpoint, like getting guys around the golf course. If they play the second round, they're playing the same pins. It's there's the less that they have to do in terms of calculating with their caddies and less back sure. and forth. So they're like,
yeah,
you know, we can get 65 guys around the golf course and finish by 6:15 and give ourselves some time, do a playoff or sudden death, yeah. which happens almost every year. So that was his kind of rebuttal to why they don't change the pins, which makes sense. I totally agree with him, and it was fine. It was less calculating for me, but you know, I think, you know, for some of the players that are really good at it and have really good caddies, they would prefer that the pins would be changed. You know, for instance, I play with Mark Leishman. He shot 64 in the first round, and he's got a great caddy, Matty. I don't know his last name. They're both Aussies, great dudes. But he's got a professional caddy who knows what the hell he's doing. And you give somebody like William Wells, who's an amateur from Vanderbilt, I think, or Wake Forest, or one of the black and gold schools. I'm not sure. But anyway, he gets through and he's a good player, great player. But does he get through maybe if they have to change pins and they have to rethink, you know, strategy, like what club to hit? You come around a second 18, you got the exact same pin, like par threes. You're like, I don't even think about this. It's the same club that I hit last time. Let's go. No wind. Like it dumbs it down. So it takes some of the strategy out of it. So I could see where a higher level player that has status on Korn Ferry, PGA Tour or whatever would say, you know, yeah, change the pins. Cause I feel like I have an advantage. So, but anyway, yeah, it was good. It was good setup. I think they did a great job with the golf course. It was in great, great shape. You know, Pete Wendt used to be the superintendent at Kenlock, moved to Woodmont, and now is the
congressional.
Yeah, he's at congressional, but I don't know if what his title is. He is the lead superintendent of congressional, two golf courses, 2,500 members. I mean, I don't know what his exact title is, but he is an absolute genius. And every place that he's touched, he's like, he's got the Midas touch. Like,
yeah.
Everywhere that he goes, the place is impeccable. And he really flipped it. That sounds like I'm saying validify, but he flipped the script for Woodmont. And Woodmont was always a great club. And McLean, you talked about your dad being the head pro there in the 90s. But when Pete Wendt got there, he really changed things. I mean, it went from a great private club to a top notch, top 100. Private club in the U.S. I mean, it is impeccable. It's in great shape.
So, obviously, we would have led with this. Jay didn't get through. But how was
spoiler alert?
How was Leishman?
Mark was awesome. You know, I was telling you guys earlier, like we saw him on the. First tee, we're at the the first tee tent, and we shook hands and I was like, good to see you again. And yeah, right after we teed off on number 10, of Woodmont, we're walking down the fairway and he's like, damn it. He's like, I know you bloke. He's like, where do we play together? And I was like, he's like, did we play together at a PGA? And I was like, no, we didn't play together at a PGA.
I would have went with it. We did. Yeah, I just would have went with it.
Yeah, I should have. But then I had to bust his bubble and let him know that he invited me to play in his pro-am in Virginia Beach, which I was very excited to play in. It was a cool event, yeah, great setup. And he's such a great guy. Like he said, oh, that's right. I remember you're a local guy. You're from Richmond. And I was like, and he said the right things. And
yeah,
he was a good guy. But no, he was very fun to play with. I was really impressed with his short game. The guy was just, he was really, really good. The first round of golf, you know, somebody asked me, how did he play? And I was like, he played almost a perfect round of golf. He made two 30 footers, which you can't count on, but the greens were in great shape. And he birdied the par fives, three of them. He was five under there. And then he hit two wedges relatively close and made putts and didn't make any bogeys. The greens that he missed, he got up and down and he made pars. He shot 64, you know, seven under.
Sounds easy.
In theory, it sounds easy, but like when you really start breaking it down and start thinking about how you need to practice and what you need to focus on. And I would say Mark didn't hit it further than me. Mark's a big guy. He's 6'3". He's not known for hammering it off the tee, but he's not short by any means. But, you know, it was nice when I was hitting the ball solidly in the middle of the face down the fairway, I was, you know, we were the same distance, if not maybe just a little bit ahead of him. But I didn't hit it as solid as he did that much, but I was in the right rough quite a bit. But anyway, you know, like I said, really impressed with his game, just super consistent. He's super, super good guy. Like we talked the whole round. He's just a, you know, down to earth guy, got his own brewery in Virginia Beach. He lives there. Obviously, if no one knows his wife, he met his wife there playing in the Corn Ferry event, which was at the time the Nationwide event. Got married. He's been there for 10 years. But yeah, good guy, great player. Didn't play great in the second round, obviously, but we had a blast. It was fun. And he was very engaging and would talk. It wanted to take pictures with, you know, my boys when they came to watch for nine holes. He came by and gave them high fives. And, you know, both of my boys were like, who is this guy? Like, you know, this is Mark Leishman. I've told you about this because they both know who Cam Smith is. And I was like, Cam Smith's captain, his teammate for the Live Tour. And then Trey's Rippers. Eyes kind of lit up and he was like, wanted to talk to him. And Mark was great. He was very engaging with the boys. You know, he didn't have to do that. Like he's leading qualifying for the, you know, US Open. And he's talking to my boys. Like I thought that was pretty cool. Yeah.
All right. So, I mean, do we get any dirt? Like, what's his contract? Mm. You know, does he think Liv's an actual joke? He's just doing it for the money. Is Norman as big of a douchebag as we think? Like, I mean, what? I would have hit. You got any hard hitting questions out there, Jay?
Yeah, actually, I did. I said,
there we go.
And I know you'd be proud of me, Mike, because I did slip a couple in. You know me, like I'm not. I don't want to ruffle the feathers when it's especially like bro time and round. Like this guy's like we're getting along. Like I don't want to push him too hard, but I did. I went full mode reporter mode or whatever. So I was like, all right, how do you feel about world ranking points? Like, and immediately he was like, I don't give a shit, bro. He's like, I don't care. He's like, I don't care. He's like, I joined the Live Tour to play golf, to make a lot of money for my family. And he's like, and I've done that. And it's like, if I don't get world ranking points, then that's fine. I don't care. But he was not naive to say, and I was like, well, I guess so none of the guys really care about it. He's like, no, there are some guys that really care about world ranking points. And he was, which was pretty cool. He was very discreet with that. He was just like, yeah, there are some players that do care about it. I just don't care. He's like, and then we continued that conversation a couple holes later. And I was kind of commenting on Cam Smith and some of the other Aussies that he's good buddies with. I was like, it seems like a tight knit group of people, you know, the Aussies, you know, you guys all get along and, you know, you, Cam, Matt Jones, you know, let's say Herbert. And I was like, maybe not Adam Scott. He's kind of his own individual. And he's like, yeah, Adam Scott actually is. He's a great guy. He's very private though. He does his own thing. Like he's like, he basically is like, we don't hang out a lot. We don't spend a lot of time together, but he kept using the word bloke. He's a great bloke. He's a good bloke. So he's a good guy. But you know, when it came down to it, like in talking, you know, for the, you know, what they're doing with Liv, he was like, look, I don't really care. And some of the guys do, but we live to, he said, we live to work. We don't work to live. He kept saying that. over and over. I thought it was pretty cool. And that's where I was getting at. Sorry, it took me a while to get there. But, the roundabout matter was like where he is in his life and his career and why he decided to go to the Live. He was like, we work to live, not live to work. And I think that is flipped around when it comes to the culture in the U.S. Like, I think some people, they work to live. Like, they get up every day. Like, I got to go to work. I got to work. And then I can do maybe a little bit at the end of the day. And he's like, we don't think that way. He's like, we live first and then we work to facilitate how we live, which I thought was pretty cool. And he said it a couple of times. And it's just different personality, you know, and this is coming from a guy who shot 64, played flawless golf in the first round, and then shot, followed up with a 74, handled it with grace. He grumbled a couple of times for some bad shots.
He made two doubles, right?
Made two doubles. I mean, hell, I beat him in the second round.
Fucking right you did.
I mean, and I got no business beating this guy. I mean, he plays every day, you know? And that just goes to show golf and how it works. And that's not to say, I beat Mark Leishman. I'm a better golfer than Mark Leishman. That's not, absolutely not the case. But that's what's cool about the game is like, you can get out there and compete with somebody who is Mark Leishman is a top 100 player in the world. And we talk about that world.
He's younger than I thought. I thought he was
He's 2 years younger than me. He just turned 40 this past October. We talked.
Yeah, about I thought he was a little older than you,
which is pretty cool. We did talk about that. Which he said that he did his 40th birthday party with Cam Smith in Miami, and they said you have to have a beer in your hand by 10, or you have to have a 10 beers. You have to drink 10 beers by another time of the day. I can't remember the slogan, but he was like, I woke up the next day. He was there on a bachelor party. I guess it was, I don't know if it was Cam Smith's bachelor party or somebody else's, but he woke up the next morning and they were going fishing early. He was like, I'm not going fishing. So they had the beers on the countertop ready for him. And he was like, all right, like I need to drink these. So he went at it and drank these beers and got them ready when they came back. I mean, he was ready to go. He said, you know, it was a different 40th birthday party than most people, but he had a great time and he was with his good buddies. So,
I always liked Leish, you know, I guess when he went to Live, he was probably towards, you know, the backside of his career, maybe not quite being able to compete. And so he was one of those guys that I kind of got, you know, and what you're saying kind of equates to it. He's just like, I just want to chill and play golf. And oh, by the way, this place can make me a lot of money to do it. And
yeah. Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think, I mean, the more I'm around most of the guys, you know, that decided to take that payout, a lot of them are foreigners. They didn't grow up in the U.S. culture, so they're just not as attached to it, I guess, is the best way to say it. They're just not, they're not as enamored with the legacy of their career. It's like, I don't care. Like, they're like, I don't, like, it's not like they live in their hometown where everyone is like, you know, looking at their accolades, like, hey, you did this, you did this. Oh, you're a winner. You're so great. You know, he's just like, It doesn't really matter to me. He's like, I'm married. I got two boys and I want to be able to, that money allows me the freedom to do the things that I want to do with my family. And I respect that. I mean, granted, selfishly as a fan, you're like, man, you almost won two majors. Like, I want to see that, you know, you want to watch that as a fan. It's like watching an actor. Like, oh, you haven't come out with a movie in 5 years, like, oh, you're coming out with a movie. I want to watch that movie because you're one of my favorite actors. And, you know, as an athlete, you're a fan. You want to watch them perform. And if you don't see them as much and you're like, ah, man, I wish you were performing in the US Open or the Masters or the PGA or the British Open, you know, you want to watch your favorite players or your favorite actors compete. So I think that's more of a personal thing, but after hearing, you know, their side of things, I think it makes sense. And I don't blame them at all. I mean, when, you know, when he was talking to me, explaining why he did it, you know, in a roundabout way, which I've already explained, it was like, oh, why wouldn't anyone do that? You know?
Yeah, you got to respect it.
I mean, I was like, he was like, hey, he's like, man, he literally was just, he spoke so genuinely, which I thought was really cool. He was just like, he's like, ah, he's like, I'm making so much money doing this. And he's like, this is more money that I ever could have dreamed of. And I didn't have to even do anything. Like, it wasn't contingent on how I played golf. He's like, that would be so disrespectful to my family for me to not do this. He didn't say that specifically, so I don't want to put words in his mouth, but that was the way he phrased it. He was like, this would be silly for me not to do this, you know, and based on his prior conversations about his family and his boys and family time, he really enjoys being around his family. Like, he wants to be involved. And then, you know, we talked a lot about, he asked why I stopped playing golf and, you know, why, you know, what I was doing now. And obviously got into that. And I was just like, look, I got to a point where 14 years in, I was going to have to go back to, I missed final stage by a shot. And I was going to have to go back to Q school again the following year. And I was going to have to either try to play Latin American tour, Canadian tour, you know, whatever. And I was 36 at the time. And he's like, oh shit. It's like, you were going to have to go back and go do like lower level third tier mini tour stuff. And I was like, yeah. And he's like, oh, I wouldn't have done that. You know, that's ridiculous. You know, it's because you know, you got two kids at the house and you're running around for 10 weeks at a time, you know, who's there with them, you know, who's raising them. So it was tough. It was cool to kind of get.
I'm curious what his take would have been if he was 27, not 37, 38, when started, right? You know, yeah. I think that changes things a lot.
100%. 100%. He had already established himself as a great player, and he had earned that bankroll from Liv at that point. So,
yeah.
Now, if he were 10 years prior, not finishing as high as he did in so many majors, do they offer him the same amount of money? Maybe not.
Well, and does his priorities change at that point too? Like, your priorities change in life.
100%. 100%. It's a different conversation entirely. You know, it's a different conversation entirely. And we all are in our mid to late 30s now. Like, we're all late 30s now.
Mm-hmm. 40, we all have 42.
Multiple kids.
42, by the way.
We'll let you live that out, Jay.
I don't want to false represent here. I am super great, and I'm 42 years old.
I turned 38 this year. I think Mike and I are on basically the same. How old are you, Mike?
I turned 40, bud.
You old fuckers.
I wish I wasn't saying it, but I turned 40.
So we're all basically 40.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm around the corner from being 40.
Yeah.
My wife's last few months of sleeping with a 30-year-old.
She's not enjoyed it once.
I'm not at this point, I'm not worried about her enjoyment. This, you know, it's it's a means to an end.
We're all having fun here. But Jay, to go back to what you were saying, you do bring up a great point. Because the decisions you make when you're single and in your 20s are very different than the decisions you make when you have kids.
Yeah.
You have bills. You've got a wife at home.
100%. Different priorities. 100%. No.
Priorities are totally different. And, you know, even on the backside of that, it's like, even if you're doing well, even if you're a millionaire, you know, if you have an opportunity to set your family up for life, how do you not take that? Yeah, like, I get why guys don't, but those guys are mostly also very financially sound at this point. But on the backside of that, it's like, all I have to do is click a button. I got to DocuSign this to take care of my family for life. It's not a hard choice for me.
I think
at the, not to get into this whole live rabbit hole, but
there is a point
that we're talking about professional athletes, and at some point you want to win the biggest events in the world. That should fucking matter.
And I think it does.
Yeah.
Like, I think it
does. And being competitive and being a pure athlete and competing, like, that matters too.
All of that does. I'm not negating anything you say. But right now, if I told you.
Well, I'm not doing this again. We did this eight times years ago.
I know. Let's go ahead and jump down. You have a wife and two kids. Beautiful family.
I get it. That's why I said it's different.
If Mark Leishman's 27
in the prime of his career trying to win majors, and you could potentially not I think it matters. Like, that's why I question some of these college kids coming out and joining LIV. It's like, do you really want to compete, or do you just want the easy check? Do you want to be great and win majors?
But that's a different question at that age. It's a different question at that age.
Yeah, that's why I said it's all. It's very age dependent. Different question. It's very situation dependent.
At our age, if you're able to sign one DocuSign and set your family up for life, I don't think it's as hard. I'm not doing this.
I'm not doing this.
I'm not trying to go down a rabbit hole with you, Mike. I'm not.
This was two years ago. I'm not doing this.
It is not my purpose in saying this. I'm just saying straight up, I get it. That's all I'm saying. I get it. At the age that I'm at, if I was able to go ahead and make one click and say my family is set for life, I would do it. I do it last night. I do it tonight.
I get it. We've known that for 2 years.
I think it really comes down to, like, when you kind of evaluate each person, each player and their situation and what's important to them. And I think we have to, as fans, we have to kind of draw back and pull ourselves away from, you know, just the fandom of it all. And like, okay, I want you to do this. I want you to be this person. I want you to try to win this tournament. Why don't you want to do that? Because that's what you should do. And I think when we can look at it that way and we're like, you know what, I can admit, I want Mark Leishman to play in the majors. I want him to get world ranking points because playing with him, like, I'm a fan of his and I want him to play well. I want to see him in these majors. And I'm sure there's other players, LIV Tour players that fans say the same thing about. But in the grand scheme of things, you're like, the payoff, you know, definitely outweighs the risk of not taking it. So I think that's where a lot of those guys, not all of them, some of them, bypass that 100% and just said, you know what, screw it. I'm going to take a big payment. You know, I know I've got a big fan base. I don't care. Screw them. But there are some that probably thought about it a little bit and said, you know, hey, this is too good to be true. Like, I've got to take this.
100%, Jay, I totally agree with you. If I was in my mid-20s, I didn't have kids, and I'm chasing Masters and chasing green jackets, different story entirely. I don't know what it's like to have that parental feeling in your head where it's like, There are more things relying on me than I necessarily knew. Before that, it was just me. I'm relying on me to just do me. I'm 25. I don't have any kids. I don't necessarily have a family right now. And I'm here to win U.S. Opens, Green Jackets, the Open Championship, the PGA. It's like, yeah, no, I don't need that. I'm doing me and I'm good. Yeah. And I also have a $100 million contract behind me from Nike or whoever else it is. I'm good. Yeah. I don't need money in that.
And the opportunity is still there. I mean, think of it like from marketing dollars. Like, if you look at like NFL running back, so to speak, if I'm a 25-year-old NFL running back, then I'm still in the prime of my career. If I'm a 31-year-old running back in the NFL, you are on the back end. Like, you maybe have back 1 or 2 years at the most. So, you know, I think that there's something to be said for that too. Like, if you're, you know, young in the mid-20s, you got so much opportunity ahead of you. You're like, okay, does this whole thing, you know, shake out in the next 2 or 3 years? I don't want to commit to one side and then be screwed on the back end. And I want to still have the opportunity to play in all four majors, because if I do win, you know, one or two majors, which every player, you know, in the top 50 thinks that they can do, if you think that you can win one of those, the payoff is way greater than you taking the payoff to go to live at your discount rate. So you're weighing your potential with what you have in front of you right now, and that's a tough gig.
Yeah, and that's why as a fan, I want to see the guys that want to compete. I mean, I don't.
Right?
I think like a DJ pisses me off because the guy has cashed in. Like he does all the reports, all the rumors are this guy does not practice.
Yeah,
he does not show up to the clubs. There was a rumor going around that he does not show up to practice. He legitimately spent months not touching a golf club until the week before the first live event this year, and that's been substantiated.
And this is a guy that has
immense talent, like the number one player in the world at one point, who has unbelievable talent. And to me, as a fan of competing in the sport, it's like, God, what a fucking waste this is.
Can you have
some heart and compete? And like, that's what I love Tiger so much. That's why I like Tom Brady so much. Like, these guys were the ultimate competitors, and that's what I'm watching people and teams and individuals compete in a sport. That's what's entertaining to me. And so
I don't think I agree with you 100%. I don't think that's a product of going to the Live Tour. I think that's a product of him just not giving a shit.
Because I think he's making so much money that he doesn't have to play well to make a bunch of money.
Yeah, but I think there's plenty of guys that are playing the Live Tour that still want to play good golf.
Yeah, there are.
So I wouldn't associate, you know, Dustin Johnson's mentality with Live Tour golf. I think that's a Dustin Johnson thing. Like, he just doesn't give a shit, and he's made a bunch of money, and he's like, I don't need to practice.
I
agree with that, like, 100%. Like, and I think for the people that I like watching on the Live Tour, the players like Cam Smith, I think is an incredible player. Like, I love watching. That guy still wants to win. Like, he's still going around, traveling around, playing in not just Live events, but playing in DP World events or whatever Asian events that he can get into. And he's playing golf and he wants to compete. Mm-hmm. Like, that's who I want to watch.
Yeah. Like, I'm not saying everyone's like that, but when you give someone that much money, there's more likelihood that that's going to happen than someone cashing in.
That's no different than the PGA Tour and the sponsorship dollars that have been given. Sure. I mean, I think that they're one and the same.
I can't stand when a player in a team sport has his career year and a contract year.
Yeah.
Signs a big contract, and then the guy sucks because he doesn't try anymore. It's like, fuck you, dude. Like, you know?
Yeah.
Like, you got your money, so now you're just going to cash in. You're not going to work hard. Like, I don't know.
That's annoying. Or they're in a contract year, and they make their money, and they want to fulfill that obligation, and they overdo it and overthink it. There's a lot of that.
There's a lot of that, yeah.
Yeah.
They can't handle the pressure of the big contract.
Yeah, which
so
I've got more respect for that than I do the guy who just says, "Yeah, I got paid, I'm out." Yeah, I hate that too. That's annoying.
Yeah. Any other? Let's get back to longest day in golf, because there's always some good stories.
Yeah.
First of all, Jay, dude, so proud of you, man. Congrats! It was fun refreshing the screen. I had it up on my office computer. I made sure to have it up on the golf shop computer, and I had it up on my phone. So pretty much wherever I was hitting refresh and.
Nice.
It was a blast to follow along. They're killing me with the 9-hole updates the first 18.
I know.
What the hell's going on here?
Well, luckily the second 18, I was playing with Mark Leishman, who led after the first round. So we had a walking score with us. So we got all those scores updated. But I appreciate that. No, it's fun. I'm the same. I'm a fan of golf, and I had some other buddies that were playing and that qualified, which is fun. Like Andy Swoboda played a lot of golf with Mini Tour Golf and played with them in college. He went to St. John's and he actually started at NC State. He got through, I'm not sure if this has got to be at least his second US Open, and he just played in the PGA.
But this incredible. Is
he's in the Met section in New York.
This is like his sixth US Open.
It wouldn't surprise me.
Since 2017 or something like that. This is sixth.
That's incredible. I know he's played in a couple USA, multiple PGAs.
He's played a lot. I mean, the guy is a stud. They had a really good story about him. That's the only reason that I know any of these stats. I watched the story on him. I love his move. by the way.
Oh, he hits it so solid.
Love his so move. Solid. It's a little different, but I remember I watched it. I'm like, oh, that's natural. That's good motion. Clubs not, in the right places.
Not a lot of extension at the top. He really hit early, but like he just hits it so good. And we've talked about Andy on this podcast. And, you know, in the past, I had one win in college. I had 6 seconds, and 5 of those seconds were to Andy Swoboda. 5 respect, of the 6.
Respect.
Gotta if Andy is not, if Andy goes to another school, I have 6 wins in college. But because he decided to transfer to St. John's and leave NC State, he's got 5 more wins and I've got 5 more seconds. But we roomed together a couple times on the road in the first 5 or 6 years of turning pro, and he's a good guy. He's one of the best ball strikers I've ever played with. Like, I've never seen the guy like really miss hit it. You know, those guys that you play with, there's probably a handful of guys that, you know, you're like, this guy flushes it. And people always ask, they say, oh, who is the best player that never made it on the PGA Tour? And I can't say Andy because he did make it on the PGA Tour, but I can say Andy is one of the best ball strikers that I've ever played with that you really probably have never heard of. And that's coming. That's from a lot of guys that have been PGA Tour members for years and years and years. So he's got it figured out. He flushes it. So excited to see how he finishes off at the.
But just let the listeners know who Jay was competing against. So we actually, I think there was 4 LIV guys in your site. Sebastian Munoz, Mark Leishman, Lucas Herbert, Kieran Vincent. Did you go pull on Kieran Vincent's afro thing?
I didn't even see him. I heard that he was playing, but I didn't even see him.
I would have just walked up to him and said, hey, Kieran, did John Rahm have any idea who the fuck you were when they assigned you to his team?
Yeah.
You know, John Rahm was like, who is on my team?
What? Who's on my team? Speaking of that, you know, I did do a little reporting with Mark Leishman, and I was like, how does this whole system work? Like, who's got, you know, stake in the company or the club? And, you know, I looked at his bag. I was like, you know, I was like, Mark, what does Ripper's GC mean? Is that Ripper's golf club? And he was like, I think so. Yeah, I think that's right.
He's like, that tells me all I need to know.
He does not care about this stuff. But when it comes to relegation, it was him, Cam, they are really good buddies, apparently, and then Matt Jones, and then they had a player that they relegated last year, and then it brought another player in. And I was like, who makes that decision? And he said, you know, the captain makes the decision with the LIV Tour. So they decide that together. Cam has ownership of the club. And they, when I signed on or signed my contract, they said, do you want to buy ownership of the club? And Mark was like, no, I just want my cash. Give me my cash. I'm out of here. Which is cool. I was like, I don't blame you, dude. I don't blame you.
Oh, but okay. So Cam organizes it with Vince McMahon. I mean, yep. Greg Norman.
So Cam for, and again, I don't know how every team works. If some of the members have bought a small percentage some of the team members have bought a small percentage of the team, it could be, you know, delegated differently. But for this team, the Rippers, Cam is the sole owner with LIV, and he makes the decision on who is relegated and who is not relegated. So,
yeah. All right. But you had, I mean, the guy who was co-medalist, Tim, I think it's Veding is how you pronounce it. He's from Sweden. The guy is like the hottest player on the Korn Ferry Tour right now. He's leading the money list. He's won back-to-back times, like just a pure stud that's going to be on the PGA Tour next year.
Yeah.
Isaiah Salinda, who was also the co-medalist, he was an All-American a few years ago at Stanford. So to our listeners, this is no fucking joke what our man Jay Bird
Oh yeah, I mean no, I mean it was fun. I mean, I finished kind of on the bottom third of the list there, 40 something out of 67.
But hey,
guys, but you know, I mean, I will say that like I would have needed to play really incredible golf to shoot 8 under to get in a playoff. Like four under per round out there is. That was good golf. I mean, it was, if you were driving the ball well, you were going to have a lot of wedges because the fairways were firm, but you know, it's not an easy golf course. There's still a lot of dog legs, a lot of little intricacies of the golf course and then some slopes in the greens. I mean, you had to play good golf. I mean, it went 8, 9, 8, 8, 7, 7, 4, and then 4, 2, like, the top 10 guys were only 1 under par out of 65 guys. So yeah, there was not a lot of guys under par in this event. So it wasn't like it was like playing super easy, but the guys who were playing well took advantage of the conditions. But it was fun. I mean, I think it's always fun to compete with the best players in the world, you know, so to speak. I mean, obviously not PGA Tour status, but a lot of great players, I should say, playing in the same event and seeing how they play, playing with Mark Leishman, watching him play again. I haven't played with him in a while. First round, he played great golf, made it look easy. And then the second round, he shot 74 and I beat him by 2 shots. And you're like, wait a second, you know, what happened?
That shows how fine the line is.
It just shows how tough the game is. And I think other people are like, oh yeah, you beat Mark in the second round. I was like, I get it. I was like, actually, I was probably beating him by like 7 or 8 shots for most of the day. But there wasn't a point during that round that I'm like, I'm better than that guy. If that makes sense. Like, mm-hmm. You can tell the skill set of a player, and then he just hit a couple bad shots and made a couple dumb decisions at the wrong time. And then he shot 74 when he should have shot 2 under and qualified and moved on.
Who was about that other guy that you played with? DeCilio.
Yeah, this guy, Steven DeCilio. DeCilio played at, and I haven't looked up the stats on this guy, but he played at Duke. He's from Georgia somewhere. He grew up in Boston, so you'd love him, Mike.
Yeah. I mean, from Swampscott, Mass, ends in a vowel. Love the guy.
Love the guy.
Name ends in a vowel.
But he grew up in Boston and now lives in somewhere in Georgia, Atlanta area, went to Duke. I haven't looked up his stats to see what he has done, what his collegiate career looked like, but this is his third year as a pro. But I mean, I was a long hitter when I first came out. This Steven is 24, I think maybe. And when I was 24, I was smashing it. I was hitting it hard. You know, granted, we didn't have the technology we have now, but I was still smashing it. I was one of the longer guys. This guy, he is the longest player that I've ever played with. The longest. Rory, Tony Finau, Bubba, JB Holmes, all these old heads that hit hard. Cam Champ. I mean, nobody hits it like this guy hits it. Nobody. Nobody. Like, he was, I mean, this is, I mean, I'm still hitting it. My ball speed is still 170s, like, when I'm hitting it, when I'm ripping it. And Mark Leishman is in the 170s, and we were both pretty comparable to distance off the tee. This guy was 30, carrying it 30 yards past us.
Yikes.
Every single swing. I mean,
Gotta roll that ball back.
I mean, it was, and he looked hard. It looked fast. He looked like, when I saw him on the first tee, I'm like, hey, good to meet you. And I'm like, this guy bombs it. Like, you can tell right away. He was like 6'2". He was 6'2" and a wiry 195, 200. And I was, when I say wiry 200, I mean like jack 200. Like, and you could see, like, you know, when a guy grabs a club and his hands are like on it like this, and it's like, he's like got a can of worms that he just opened up and they just rip around the club. And you're like, oh, this guy's squeezing this thing. He's gonna mash it. And the first tee ball on number 10 at Woodmont is a 580 yard par five. I've heel cut this thing into the right rough, which I thought was a good shot, you know, given the circumstances. I hit it pretty good. I was like, got it airborne. I was like, okay. I was like, all right. Oh, heel cut right of the greens or the fairway bunker. Like I didn't even get into the bunker. I was in the right bunker. Leishman hit into the fairway bunker. I hit it right of the right bunker. And I had 320 in and I hit a five iron, you know, under the tree and just laid up to, you know, 100 yards or whatever. Just chipped it out and we walked up another 70, 80 paces and he had 200 yards in. And I think it was either a seven or a six iron that he hit in the right edge of the fairway. And he hit it. He hit a bad shot, honestly, in the right bunker and got it down for birdie, but he had 200 yards in and I had 320 in. Granted, he hit the fairway over the bunker. It ran out, but I hit it 320. I had 320. He had 200 yards in. And that was the recurring, model all day.
Apparently, distance is not the advantage, which is odd to hear.
Well, you know, I got done and I analyzed this guy's round and this guy's Steven. He just smashed it. So I was like, what? Why? He shot two over. And Mark Leishman shot four under, I guess. He shot seven under, three over. I obviously was six over, whatever, five over behind them. But why did this guy not play better? And I was like kind of going through the numbers and I was like looking at it. I was like, He hit it so much further, so much a big advantage on the par fives. Every par five he had an iron into, and some of the par fours he was hitting it up by the green, and he had chipping. He was chipping on some of the par fours, but like we've talked about on this podcast, you know, the driving the ball in play off the tee is a huge advantage, but like you've got to get the ball in the hole, like. I mean, and that's what I think that's the differentiator because between a guy like this, like he's maybe longer than anybody else on the PGA Tour. He carries at 330 and nobody on the PGA Tour carries at 330, but they also know like when I swing like that, how often am I going to hit it in play and how often am I going to be able to dial it down to be able to control my wedges and hit the ball close to the hole. And that was, in my opinion, that was the differentiator between him being able to hit the ball 330 off the tee and then still be able to hit a 50-yard pitch shot, hit it close. Whereas like somebody like Rory, everyone's like, oh, Rory, you're such a bad wedge player. I'm like, he's pretty good. He's a pretty good wedge player. It's all relative, right? Like He's the longest player on tour and the most accurate player on tour. But he still is really good with everything. Like him being a bad wedge player is still the best wedge player that you've ever seen. You know what I mean? Absolutely. And I think that's that from the viewership, like when we watch this, our expectation of Rory and what he should be able to do. And they look at stats, PGA Tour stats, and like, oh, he's so good at driving and he's just such an average to below average wedge player. And I'm like, if Rory were to come out right now and play with you at your club, any of you listeners right now, and he hit, if you put him at 100 yards on every single hole, he would hit some of the most amazing wedge shots that you've ever seen. You wouldn't even believe that you could see a player hit an iron shot or a wedge shot like that. And I think the margin's so tight for wedges and putting and chipping, you know, that's where we get skewed when we look at rankings. We just see ranking, 75th in wedge play from 100 to 125. But the number one player in the country, in the world in strokes gained putting or strokes gained wedge play from 100 to 125 is only gaining 0.3 shots on the field. Well, you're not gaining a whole lot there, but Rory's gained three shots on you off the tee, you know?
Yeah, I agree. You're very right, Jay. You're very right.
But
I love what he was saying.
Yeah, it was long. It was long-winded. I know.
No, no. McLean and I are currently battling each other through comments to you. So
I agree with everything that Jay said. I also agree with the fact that just because you hit the ball a very long way doesn't mean that you're going to score well. And I think if you have the course set up correctly, that it can be more penalizing for the guys that do carry it 330. Make it a little thinner up there. If you want to take that on, take it on.
I have my finger right on. I have my finger right on the mute button.
I knew you were going there.
Do it, Mike. Just go ahead and do it.
No, but I agree, Mike. We don't want to go down the rabbit hole. But McLean, I do agree with you. Like I've seen too many. I just think the distance thing. We're not going to go down rollback. We're not going to do it. We're not going there. I get it. But I'm just balancing the situation. I do think that there's been so much of a premium put on the distance of a golf course and how that is affected by the distance of the ball. And I think there's a few more factors that need to be evaluated before we immediately go back to the ball's going too far. That's all I'm saying. Like,
I will leave it right there. I agree with you, Jay.
And Mike, I'm kind of in the middle with this. Like, I do think it can get carried away with, or we can get carried away with the ball and going too far. And I do think somehow we got to get a handle on it. But I do think there's plenty of opportunity for us to challenge the players a little bit more off the tee. To try to relegate that in a sense to bring it back and be like, hey, okay, yeah,
you don't have to drive far with the ball. 14 times. You don't have to drive her 14 times.
Yeah. Yeah. No.
All right. Give me just 30 seconds. We're not doing this. Give me 30 seconds and we're going to go on to the memorial picks.
Well, it depends on what this 30 seconds is.
No, there's no rebuttal. You guys have talked. Well, no rebuttal.
You can't say no rebuttal.
Yeah, I can.
Go ahead.
I can say no rebuttal. I let you guys talk. I'm going to talk, and then we're going to be done with it.
I haven't really talked that much. I've been listening, and I think
you've said enough by the fucking smug look on your face the entire time.
I might say more, but go ahead. Give us your 30. Give us your 30, Mike. Go ahead. Give us your 30.
The USGA is not doing this to punish a certain player. They're not doing this to curtail scoring. It has nothing to do with how you get the golf ball in the hole. It's purely about we're running out of golf courses to handle these guys. It's plain and simple. They admit that the golf ball was going further for a number of reasons. Instructions better, TrackMans, yes, equipment's better, agronomy's better. There's a lot of reasons. There's more athletes playing the game. There's a lot of reasons the golf ball is going further. They admit that. They have never said anything about scoring. It is that we're running out of golf courses that can handle this. And if we get longer and longer and longer, which is going to happen because the athletes are getting better and better and better, the freak in this generation becomes the norm in the next generation. And it's only going to get longer and longer. So something has to be done. And this is the easiest, quickest, fastest way to put a speed bump on this. But the straw man argument of they're trying to curtail scoring and all is they've never said that, and they can't regulate golf courses. That's not what they do. That's an agronomy issue. They regulate equipment and rules. So they're doing what they can. Something has to be done. We cannot let this go on and on and on. If something has to be done at the professional level. And we're done. We're on to the memorial.
We're not done. We're not done. I have one
rebuttal. All right, then I'm going to walk out of the room and text me when you guys are done.
I get my 30 seconds. You got 30 seconds, I get mine, right? That's only fair. We're all about equality.
You're using up your time. Let's go.
What I would say is when you talk about it, it's the easiest way to do this, it's not. Talk to the ball manufacturers. On the millions upon millions upon millions of dollars that it would take to develop a different golf ball. because it's a massive cost to the manufacturers. On the backside of this, I would say that if we're able to make it more penalizing in the longer distances, to say that, all right, if you're going to hit 330 off the tee,
I can't.
The fairway's much more narrow there. There's more rough there. There's more penalizing opportunities there. To where all of a sudden it's like, hey, maybe I shouldn't hit driver here. Maybe I should hit 3-wood. Maybe I should hit 5-wood. Maybe I should hit 2-iron. All of a sudden it makes you have to craft your game a little bit more. And fuck off. And on the backside of that, it puts it to a point where the guy has to be more creative. He just can't bash it off the tee nonstop. It then all of a sudden makes it a much more even playing field to where the guy says, look, I can't just bash driver everywhere. I have to hit a 3-wood or a 5-wood, find the fairway here. I can hit driver here. I can hit driver here, but if I hit driver here, I'm going to a much smaller part of the fairway, and my accuracy has to then take precedent over me being able to hit a shot that allows me to score well. So there's a lot of opportunity to where you can grow that rough in, you can shrink the fairway, you can make it a much more penalizing shot for someone that misses the fairway at 330 yards. That's not that hard. On the backside, to say that it's much easier to roll the ball back. No, talk to the ball manufacturers. It costs tens of millions of dollars to create a different golf ball. It's not like it's just like, hey guys, flip a switch. It's not a big deal. It's not a big monetarily, it's not a big issue. It is. So on the backside, I look at it and I'm like, hey, look, if we just make the golf courses a little bit more penalizing in those long distance tee shots, then I think we make them have to craft the game a little bit more. They have to be a little more crafty around the golf course. They have to then think about it a little bit more. The game is better.
Again, the USGA can't regulate every agronomist, every superintendent, every course in the world on how they're going to.
They do it every day. They do it every day. They do it every day.
They can't, though. It's not how they do it. It's not real. That's a bad faith argument. And if you want to get to the manufacturers want to tell me every year that they're spending hundreds of millions of dollars to improve their product. So they're just going to do it for a different end game. They're still going to spend the money regardless.
Let me ask you this question. Does the USGA not take over a golf course 2 years prior to the US?
One a year. One golf course a year, we're talking.
The PGA does the same thing.
One a year for the PGA.
The PGA does the same thing. Every single golf tournament that they go to, the PGA Tour has control of the golf course running up to that to make it PGA Tour.
They don't.
Am I wrong?
This is bad. I'm not doing it. I'm done. I'm not doing it. You can keep talking if you want. I'll walk away. You can text me when you're done, and we'll talk about the memorial.
You're not admitting to the fact that
the USGA controls one golf course a year for the professionals.
You're right.
One.
You're right. Leave the USGA out of it. Do you not agree?
They're the ones that make the rules, dude. The PGA Tour is that make the rules. They're not going to do something to piss the players off.
But any PGA Tour venue.
Yes, they control it, but they're not going to do this, dude. They're not going to do it.
The ruling body.
They're not a ruling body.
Golf course. I'm sorry. The PGA Tour is the ruling body.
It's not a ruling body. It's not a ruling governing body of the game.
Do they take control of the golf course?
Events.
Do they take control of the golf course prior to the event?
Yes, they do.
Set up. They do?
Yes. I'm not going to disagree with that. But they're not going to do this, dude. They're not going to do it.
Why not?
Because they're going to piss the players off. They're not going to do it.
That doesn't make sense. What you're saying doesn't make sense.
No, what you're saying doesn't make any sense.
No, if they have control of the setup, all I'm saying.
I understand that, but the PGA Tour, who handles most of the events for professionals, will not do the setup like you're talking about.
Why not?
Because they won't, because they're going to piss the players off. They're not going to do them to piss the players off.
But the USGA is going to do something that pisses the players off. So why not can we all get on the same wavelength?
All right, I'm done.
And say, let's make the setups a little tougher. Why can't we make the setups a little tougher, Jay?
Why can't we make them tougher?
Why can't we make the setup a little? All you got to do is grow it in a little bit. Let's make it a little tougher.
He's back. All right. We're talking about
That was quick.
We're talking about the memorial, and we're never talking about rollback ever again.
Hey, look, I'm going to tell you, Jay signed off last time. That was a bullshit. I'm done. Jay completely quit the podcast last time.
I am never talking rollback again with you, ever.
We're not talking rollback. We're just talking setup of the golf course. We're just talking golf course setup, done. Right?
Let's go. The memorial's this week. One of my favorite events. I'm wearing the t-shirts. You got great milkshakes. Let's fucking go. Make your picks.
All right, I won. I'm going first. All right, I'm gonna.
Fucking stupid.
I'm gonna start from the bottom like I normally do. I'm not gonna lie. I did do a little research, but there's a couple of people in here that I'm not sure of, and probably needed a little bit more research to put them in the lineup. But anyway. At the bottom, $6,500, Mr. Lee Hodges has actually played some pretty good golf last three weeks, 12th at the Charles Schwab, 12th at the PGA, 24th at the Wells Fargo. So playing some consistent golf and has decent history here. The Memorial, then jumping up, Mr. Christian Bezuidenhout. 17th last or 2 weeks ago at the, actually it was probably 3 weeks ago at the Charles Schwab. Didn't play great at the PGA Championship, missed the cut, 79th. And the Wells Fargo finished 16th the week prior. But for the amount of birdies he makes and the price point, pretty good. Jumping up, Siwoo Kim, $7,700. He loves this place. The guy's played some really good golf here. Let's see. He finished 4th last year, 13th, 9th, 18th in the last 4 years. So guy likes this golf course. And he's been doing an incredible job with strokes gained in the last like 10 weeks or so. So the thing that's holding him back is his putting. If he has a decent putting week, kind of like Scottie Scheffler was, you know, a year ago, he's going to finish in the top five, if not win. So jumping up to Mr. Sugar Shane Lowry, loves these tough golf courses. 33rd last week at the RBC, 6th at the PGA Championship. I mean, you know, again, we all know how tough Memorial is, and he loves these championship-style golf courses. And at $7,900, it's a pretty good price point. Then jumping up $8,000, Mr. Russell Henley. 23rd last week at the PGA, 10th at the Wells Fargo, 12th at the RBC, 38th at the Masters, 4th at the Valero. We all know he's super consistent ball striker. It's just a matter of how he does putting. So if he gets hot putting, he's going to play well. And then jumping up, I've got a lot of, you know, lower mid-tier guys, but last but not least, the number one player in the world, I was kind of trying to think of something clever to say about him getting arrested, but I couldn't think of it. So, needless to say, Scottie Scheffler, 12-5, which I think is actually it's not bad pricing on DraftKings. I feel like it probably should be higher, and there should be a bigger gap between him and who is next up?
Rory.
11 or $1,500 between him and Rory. That gap's too tight. I think it should be $2,500. So I know it's a gamble to throw him in there, but if he does play good golf and wins, then it's worth it. If he doesn't and finishes top five, still may work out. But if he plays crappy and finishes outside the top 10, then I'll probably lose. So here it is. That's the chance I'm taking.
McLean?
Mike, I just want you to know that I love you.
I'm never talking rollback with you ever again, just to let you know.
There's literally no chance. We have a podcast, so we're definitely talking about it. From the top to the bottom, I got Colin Morikawa, 9,800. Tommy Fleetwood, 9,100. I've got Max Homa, 8,700. Shane Lowry, 7,900. Mackenzie Hughes, 7,100, and Ricky Fowler at 7,000. I'm sorry I missed last week, boys. I hope you picked up some ground on me.
It's still ugly. I'm not going to even go over the.
Do you want to go over the yearly results?
No, we're good.
I mean, no, I don't know. I don't know how it's going.
We'll set that aside with the rollback discussion.
It's never leaving.
All right. Muirfield Village Memorial. You know, typical Jack Nicklaus courses, they say, are second shot golf courses. But if you don't hit it in the fairway here, then you're fucked for those second shots that you need to hit. So while it's a kind of a big golf course and long, it's not the longest that these guys play. So I went with guys that are going to drive it in the fairway, hit a lot of greens, have decent, you know, there's not a ton of short grass around the greens. There's a lot of that thick rough that some people love right around the green. So the ball just stops 3 feet off. So
fairway,
I'll start with $6,700. Austin Eckroat, I think that was a steal for him. Got a win this year. It's playing really well. I love the value there at $6,700 is hitting it well. Then I go up to $7,700. I may swap this out because Jay and I have two of the same players like we always seem to. I have Siwoo Kim as well on my team. I may swap him out for Keegan Bradley. I was back and forth. So I'm just going to put Keegan's name out there as well. Keegan is playing solid, hitting it well. He's a good driver of the ball, good iron player, long iron player. And so he fits well at Muirfield. Then I go up to Russell Henley for the reasons Jay stated earlier at 8,000. Then I go up to this guy is could be a sneaky little win here for this guy. Ben on $8,400. I just love him on this golf course with the way he's playing. And then here's my one that I'm really questioning. He hasn't played great this year, but he has an unbelievable track record. $9,400, Patrick Cantlay.
Mm-hmm.
I don't like him.
I don't like him either, but he loves this golf course. He's played okay, not great this year. So I'm a little nervous at that one. And then I go up to my whoopee, $9,800, Colin Morikawa. Has just been playing awesome, pure ball striker. He's going to hit a ton of fairways here, a ton of greens. He's going to finish top five at the worst, if not win.
Oh, wow. At the worst.
I like that.
Mm-hmm.
Good for you.
Thank you. See, I even got my Muirfield Village milkshake t-shirt on for the show.
That's cool.
Yeah.
How'd you get to Muirfield Village?
Manufacturer who's going to spend so much money.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I get that.
Because they never spend money. So,
oh yeah, no, we don't spend money.
All right, that's
it. Jay, he wants to hate me so bad.
Great, what a great show! Yeah, awesome.
Always take care of my guy. Always take care of my guy.
and we're signing out for the week. We'll be back next week to discuss Muirfield and preview the U.S. Open. Cheers.